21. Hayes, dead. Sue Cook's voice was shaking. Ordinarily, it'd be hard to tell whether it was through emotion or because the pubs had yet to open. But this was 3 p.m., so I knew it was the former. She'd been phoning for an hour. Something must be wrong. But something wasn't wrong. Something was right. Tony Hayes is dead, her stutter, not mine. This was the sort of thing Sue did for a laugh all the time, but on this occasion, I knew she was genuine. Hayes was dead. I bowed my head for a full minute to spare a thought for his loved ones. A tear tumbled down my cheek as I pitied his younglings. Only then did I begin to smile. Whatever your views on human death, this was a good thing to happen. The world, the medium of TV, and more specifically my mental well-being, were all improved by the death of Tony Hayes, 41. I mined Sue for the key pieces of info. He'd fallen off a roof trying to fix a TV aerial. My first reaction? The interference probably had nothing to do with the aerial, more likely caused by wide-band impulsive noise generated by nearby heating thermostat. That's basic. I chuckled to myself. He was even clueless about television at home. Can't say I'm surprised. My second, who's taking over? I closed my eyes and waited for the answer. Not that I was desperate. I had plenty of ideas, and I was in demand for broadcasting work elsewhere. Hamilton Waterbreaks had penciled me as an understudy for their next corporate video. I was in the early stages of repurposing Up with the Partridge for TV, and the pilot script for Swallow had received admiring glances whenever I left it poking out of my bag. But as the nation's broadcaster, the BBC was probably my more natural home. Whether I would deign to return depended on the identity of Hayes' successor. Sue grunted with pleasure. "They've only gone and given it to Chris Feather," she said. Then she had to go, because the 3:50 was starting and she had a bet on. This was the dream scenario. Before his liver transplant, Chris Feather had been a rising star at BBC, blessed with the common touch and not a clever clogs. You wouldn't find Chris in an ivory tower, unless the ivory tower is the name of a pub. Our paths had crossed in local radio when he'd been a fledgling producer, and I'd been impressed by his way with people and his knowledge of ELO. It was he who alerted me to the fact that Roy Wood could play bassoon. For his part, Chris had been blown away by my tenacity, my restless creativity, and the fact that the camera/microphone loved me. He pledged that we work together in TV. I still have a beer mat on which he scrawled that very promise. Yes, he drank too much, and yes, he was slovenly, and coasted through several years of his career, and wasn't a student of the genre in the way that I was. Chris was more of a casual observer. Chris was the best man for the job, and I'm not just saying that because he liked me. It was only polite that I got in touch to offer my congratulations, but that could wait. First, I had to be there for Jane Hayes. I barely knew her, and she'd not exactly covered herself in glory by marrying an idiot like Tony, but widows are needy people, and I was going to do everything in my power to support her. So I sent her a travel clock wrapped in black tissue paper and in a black box, not the ones from aircraft. The card was fashioned from black card. Inside, in silver pentel, I'd simply written, "You are really sad," and I'd made the O of the word you into a smiley face. I thought about doing a sad face, but I wanted it to be a celebration of his life. I posted it to her and only then realized I'd forgotten to sign it. On the day of the funeral, I was one of the first to arrive. To my surprise, Chris Feather was there too. Clearly this wasn't the forum to discuss my employment at the BBC, so I acknowledged each other with a nod and set about comforting Jane. Jane was bearing up well, but as I approached, I could see the suffering in and around her eyes. I held her and we cried together. She was happy with the travel clock, but was still upset at being widowed. That's understandable. I hadn't been expecting a mail-order clock to cancel out the grief. I'm not suggesting that. As she wept, I continued to hug her, but in no way was it sensual. Well, certainly not on my part. I can't speak for her, and I guess she was in a bad place. Grief manifests itself in strange ways. Besides, I've always thought that people can be too quick to judge widows who strike up afternoon affairs soon after their loved one has died. Cut them some slack. It's no reflection on the dead guy. It's just that sometimes the sweet sucker of sex can help speed up the grieving process. It was a day later, and after a respectful period of mourning, For a man whose death I was over the moon about, I was in the office of the new head of programmes for BBC Television, Mr. Christopher Feather, Esquire. Chris was in good spirits, alert and sound of mind. He had drawn up a contract that would tie me to BBC TV on a £200,000-a-year deal. I broadly agreed with its terms and signed my approval on the dotted line. I wouldn't say I was particularly ecstatic. It was no less than I deserved, which meant it was one positive that cancelled out the negative of Hayes snubbing me, but not a second positive that would have pushed my happiness level higher than average. Chris took the pen. "This might seem like it was drawn up on a whim, but I know exactly what I'm doing," he said, clearly and alertly. He winced as he gripped the pen. "I trapped my hand in a door earlier, so my hand hurts and my signature might end up looking a bit weird, but I should still be able to sign this." He did so slightly gingerly, but in a very lucid and legally binding way. I shook his good hand and left.